Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
In 2019, the first Strange Realities Conference took place in Nashville, Tennessee. The pandemic and turmoil the following year could not stop 2020's conference from thriving in cyberspace as a live streaming event. Now, for 2021, the third annual Strange Realities Conference will combine these worlds into a paranormal hybrid event, live in person in Nashville and streaming online. Join us in exploring just how truly strange our reality can be with an interdimensional lineup of speakers presenting unique and intellectual perspectives on magic, mysteries, and the paranormal.
Featuring Alan Greenfield, Dr. J. Michael Bennett, a.k.a. Dr. Future, Tim Banal, Soraya Ascaf, Dr. Stephen Finley, Aaron Gullius, Amy Pachula, Brent Rains, Chris Ernst, Heather Mosher, Michael Hughes, Jose Herrera, Joshua Kutchin, Kiki Dombrowski, Nathan Isaac, P.D. Newman, Steven Snyder, a.k.a. Recluse, David Metcalf, Timothy Renner, Steve Stockton, and Bren Collier. Tickets available at StrangeRealitiesConference.com.
It's going to be amazing.
So welcome to Conspiranormal, everybody. We've got a powerhouse tonight as we gear up in the less than now 2 months to the Strange Realities Conference coming up October 15th through 17th. And we've got three of the speakers that are going to be there, hopefully, if the Delta variant doesn't kill everybody by the time that that's done. So we have Aaron Gullius.
Hi.
Christopher Ernst.
Hello, everyone.
And certainly last but not least, the great Soraya Ascath.
Hello.
The great. Hello, Soraya.
The great, yeah. Yeah. Do I have face paint on? Is that the Japanese wrestling type of great?
He's infamous. He's more than famous.
You are great, Soraya. What can we say? You definitely keep everybody entertained. And like I said, this is a powerhouse tonight, and we're going to just talk about like kind of a grab bag of topics. I'm a big fan of both Saucer Life and Where Did the Road Go, and both those guys, you guys are going to be appearing at the conference with us, as well as Chris, who...
Chris is one of the regular co-hosts on Where Did the Road Go, too, so...
Yeah.
I am off and on there. It's my pleasure to be, and I just recently visited Soraya up there, and... We shot some stuff around his haunted graveyard.
Yeah,
hope to see that soon.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that go? Do you have any experiences?
No, I wish. Like I was telling Soraya when I was, I haven't really gone. As soon as I got back, I started getting inundated with pre-semester stuff for school from the semester starting again. So I haven't had a chance to really log the footage, but I'm hoping that there's like all sorts of spectral, impressions on there and stuff like that. There wasn't anything physical. Nothing happened to us while we were there.
Yeah, nothing notable. Yeah,
nothing notable.
Sarai, have you had any weird experiences lately?
Yes. So
you've at least got one each time I have you on.
Yes. It's kind of a really hard to follow one. You want me to get into it?
Yeah. Try us. Absolutely.
So as Chris knows, Natalie, who's also on the show, is wanting her stay upstairs in my house because she needed somewhere to stay. So she also has lots of weird things happen to her. If anyone who's heard her on my show knows. And there was this day I had a dream that I was driving to Ithaca, and right at the spot on Route 89 headed toward Ithaca, where I saw a UFO back in 2001, I see this guy on a motorized scooter in the dream. Except he's like a ghost and he's like trailing like mist behind him. And I'm like, oh, that's really cool. I should stop and take a picture. But then I realized I have a dash cam because I actually do have a dash cam now. And so then other weird stuff happens in the dream. So anyway, I get up and I say something to her and she tells me she just had a dream that morning about a guy dressed all in black who was leaving ghosts behind him. And so I was like, okay, that's interesting. So then I drive to Ithaca. No guy on a scooter where I had it in the dream, but then I get down to Ithaca. And as I get down to Ithaca, there's the guy all in black on a motorized scooter like I've never seen before other than in the dream. And I got it on the dash cam. And so she pulled it apart because she kind of freaked her out. And you can't see his face.
Man without a face.
Like, he's wearing a hoodie or a windbreaker, which is what she described in the dream. That's black. And it was like over 100 degrees that day.
Right. So it would have been pretty unnatural for somebody to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it was probably just a person. There was some other aspect to it, too, that was synchronistic, but I can't remember what it was. But it was just one of those weird, like, the hell was that type of experiences? Like, I don't think it means anything, but it's like we both picked up miscellaneous junk from the same experience. But I wouldn't have noticed him. Like, I wouldn't even thought twice about it had I not had the dream.
This happened right outside the this happened pretty close to where you live?
Like this happened just outside of Ithaca.
Just outside of Ithaca. Okay.
Maybe do like a missed connections and Craigslist.
I considered it. Post a picture on Facebook. Anyone seen this guy?
Phantom man riding on bicycle.
Yeah.
But it was like, it was the type of scooter that you normally just stand on and push with your foot, except this one was motorized.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen that before until I had the dream about it. And that's exactly what he was on. And I went by with a freaking motorized scooter.
Wow.
There was one other part to it, but I can't remember what it was now.
Why do you have so many weird experiences, Sarai? Like, nothing ever happens to me.
I don't know.
And you're just so, I love how you're so nonchalant about them too. It's just like, oh, well, you know.
They really are spread out though. Like, when it seems like a lot because that's what I talk about, but in reality, I can go months without anything weird happening other than maybe sleep paralysis or weird dream. Oh, that was the other part of it. So later in the dream, I couldn't wake up. I became lucid. I was sitting in this park with this guy and there were ghosts all over the place and he couldn't see them. And I'm like, why the hell can't you see them? And then I became lucid and I tried to wake up and I couldn't wake up. And every time I tried to finally at one point I kind of woke up and immediately went back into the dream state. And I'm like, damn it. And it was getting really frustrating. So in Natalie's dream, she saw me walking around the house asleep and she couldn't wake me up. So again, I don't know if it means anything, but it was weird that all those pieces kind of came together.
Yeah, it's the idea of something of it being meaningful and synchronicities, I think, is something that people, I don't know, I think about it often these days, because I feel like a lot of discussion and maybe a lot of media that's going on sort of in the para weird world is, you know, really leaning into the idea of synchronicities and, you know, for good reason. I think, you know, Hellier has really popularized that. And I think there's also some, you know, validity to looking into that. And obviously the, you know, Downardian and Lauren Coleman's Twilight Language and sort of, you know, the precursor to it. But I do think that, you know, it's one of those things that, synchronicity can pretty easily turn into, you know, everything is connected in a way that is like these weak connections that I think you're talking about. Like, I don't know if it means anything. And I think for a lot of people, particularly when they start to follow the synchronicities for the first time, it can become like they can feel like this profundity and that there's something, you know, everything is connected in a significant way. But I guess I feel like that, you know, it's would behoove someone to sort of parse it out in the way that you're doing, like, you know, is this, in the way that Jung described a synchronicity, a meaningful coincidence? And, you know, for a lot of people personally, there might be many things that are meaningful, but I think sometimes you can kind of lose yourself in the spiral of, well, why? Oh, yeah. These are connected, but why? You know, when it's really just
obsess about it.
What's that?
You kind of over obsess about it.
Yeah.
Well, and you come from some spiritual traditions even back to your childhood that emphasize discernment of experience and things like that too, so
yeah and, like, you know, most things I'm completely blind to, you know, my own prejudices, you know, positive or not. So yeah, I definitely think in a very different way about that. And I don't, by no means am I saying that, like, people shouldn't feel, you know, something special about that happening. I think for some people, it can just be like, it can be confusing though. And it can be something that they find to be like, what's happening here?
But yeah, don't go crazy. Don't drive yourself crazy in Chapel Perilous.
No, everybody, Chapel Perilous. Sometimes it's, you know, it's necessary, I guess.
And sometimes it's just one of those things that happens.
Yeah.
There was two Adams for a minute.
Yeah,
there were.
Yeah. Oh, that's my Vardagar or whatever.
Vardoger.
Yeah. Why isn't there is there a metal band called that?
I don't think so.
There should be.
It probably should be. You're right.
Look it up in the heavy metal encyclopedia.
Encyclopedia Metallium.
There's got to be.
Friendly.
If not, snatch it up immediately, somebody.
Or just make a logo for it.
Yeah, just make a logo for
before, it. Before we started, Aaron, we were talking about some of your recent paranormal travels. I know you've been doing like some vlogs and taking saucer life on the road. You want to share any of those with us?
Yeah, I set out to do like a little history road trip. I try to do every year, and I went to the Hopewell Mound area in South Central Ohio, because I'd never been there. I still haven't been to the Great Serpent Mound. I keep missing when it's open because it doesn't open till 8 a.m. or 10 a.m., which is stupid. But I realized I was only like an hour and a half from Point Pleasant. So I decided to go to Point Pleasant because, hey, Mothman, right? And I'd been there a few times before, but I'd never been to the museum. So I was able to go to the museum, which was kind of neat. I was for a paranormal museum, I was impressed. It was more museum-y than, you know, roadside attraction-y, you know? So actually I'm the episode of the Saucer Life that is coming out next. I'm sort of hitting pause on what I was going to do. And it's a Point Pleasant episode about the trip. So including a strange experience I had. Sarai was talking about strange experiences. I had a very strange experience driving through the TNT area. I went to look at some bunkers and stuff, and I'm driving down this sort of one lane gravel track that's back there. And there is, I'm not making any of this up, guys. There is a black Cadillac in front of me. And it turns off, pulls off to the side to let me go past. And so I do. And so it's behind me. So then I sort of turn off and let it go past me because I don't trust them, right? So they're in front of me and they're about 20, 30 feet in front of me. They go over a little rise and then around a corner. And then I go around the rise. Over the rise and around the corner, and they're not there anymore. And wow. I didn't see anywhere they could have turned off. I didn't see. I mean, then, you know, there's no way, you know, giant old Cadillac, it wasn't old, but you know, big Cadillac, no way on that loose gravel it was going to, you know, accelerate out of sight quickly. So in the episode that's coming out, I have the audio from some little video messages I sent to some people like within minutes of this happening, where I sort of go through what it was. It was weird. I you know, odds are it turned off somewhere and I just didn't see. I mean, that's probably what happened, but if it hadn't been a black Cadillac in Point Pleasant, you know, I would be like, oh, this is nothing. Yeah. But it was a black Cadillac in Point Pleasant.
But what's a black Cadillac doing there?
Right. Well, if you drive all the way through the TNT area, this wildlife area, there are houses on the far side of it and people drive through there. I know that from the last time I was there. So it could have just been some old people, you know, in a Cadillac drive. But why would you take a Cadillac through? So it doesn't make any sense, but it was weird, but it was a fun trip.
Did you get a look at them? Maybe they didn't have a face.
Well, yeah, right. Okay. So here's the thing. When they drove by me, when I sort of pulled off, I looked through the side window and I could see that there were people in the car, but I couldn't discern what they actually looked like. That's a real thing, man. I was just like, I don't know what they look like. And that's another recording I sent to a friend. I told her, oh, this is weird. My wife's point of view is that, you know, if you're like behind them, they're probably like these old ladies who you can't see over the back of the seat driving their Cadillac, because that's, you know, sort of the Cadillac stereotype. But I don't know. It was weird. I didn't feel freaked out until I thought about it a little bit. Mostly I was just like, well, where'd they go? That's weird. And then later I was like, oh man, there's nowhere they could have gone. I don't think. I didn't see it. I don't know. Weird stuff, but kind of neat to have weird stuff happen once in a while.
What general year do you think the car might have been.
It was like a 90s one. It wasn't like a it wasn't like a vintage Cadillac. It wasn't from 1967.
Okay.
I know. I was like, oh, wow. This old black Cadillac from the 60s. And the guys behind it were wearing dark hats. And no, it was and the license plate didn't look like an old timey license plate. I didn't examine it closely, but I don't have any way to run the plates, although that would be pretty cool. But
would it be almost like X-Files era?
Yeah, you know, who Danny, that was the guy Mulder always like, Danny, I need you to, I don't know who Danny was, but for 9 years, he ran license plates for Mulder and whoever. But I can't remember if you actually saw Danny in any episodes, but yeah, it, weird stuff, but a good trip. And Point Pleasant is, I'm not sure what would be going on in that town if it wasn't for Mothman. You know, it's like the people who run the museum also run two other stores in town. Right. that sell like pop culture stuff, and there's the Point Pleasant Trading Company, which is sort of tourist stuff, and other stuff downtown. I mean, a lot of it wasn't open.
Well, there's that hotel is supposedly haunted. I know that,
right?
Hotel or whatever.
Yeah, and there's a Point Pleasant sort of artist co-op selling really cool stuff, but they were closed every day I was there, which is unhelpful. But you know, it's a little town in West Virginia on the Ohio River. There's not going to be a lot going on, you know, besides, yeah.
That is the exact type of experience I would expect you to have because of the stuff you're into. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so much the sort of thing I always sort of wondered, you know, about that makes me suspect it more. You know, why couldn't I just see like a ghost or something? Because it'd be like, oh wow, a ghost. But no, this is something that, like, you know, dare I say, was custom designed for me, right? Which, you know, is sometimes how it seems to work. But it's funny. My wife's perspective on it is exactly how I feel about contactees. It's fairly clear that you believe something happened to you. You know, so it's like, yep, that's, I'll take it. You know, that's a, I don't expect anybody to think it's weird. It's weird, but it's not unexplainable. I just don't happen to know how to explain it.
Very interesting.
And the bunkers, I did watch your little video about that. The bunkers they're pretty overgrown, looks like.
They are. It's really hard to see them sometimes, especially this time of year. And especially as hot and as humid as it's been, everything's just growing all over the place. And if it wasn't for the fact that like the trail sort of has a little turn off that you can see, you wouldn't know they were there sometimes. It's kind of weird. Last time I went, I had a friend with me, and it was more comfortable going into the bunkers when you've got somebody with you, because they're kind of weird. One time I was there and somebody in town told me that I need to be careful, not because of Mothman, but because of all the junkies who hang out in the bunkers sometimes, kind of touchy. The junkies are touchy, they say, but I didn't have any issues. The weird thing is you can hear the echo from inside the bunker, like 15 feet back from the door. The acoustics are really amazing. So, good trip. I urge anybody who's in the area or close by, check it out. I mean, I'm only like 5.5 hours away, which is weird. You think about Michigan and West Virginia seem like they should be further apart than that, but they're not. You just drive diagonally across Ohio, which is its own kind of hell.
Yeah. And it's right on the river too. It's like right there on the Ohio River. So like Ohio is literally right across. So yeah, I could totally see how it wouldn't be that bad of a drive. There's a similar area in Chattanooga where I'm from. There's a similar area that has those type of bunkers in it because it used to be like an ordnance works, and now it's like opened up to like Volkswagen is there and all that type of place. But you can go and you can see these bunkers, and they're really well preserved, but they were used more recently, like probably like about in like the 90s. So, but it does give you a weird sense of being in one of those places.
Yeah. Yeah. It's eerie.
Also, there is a band called Vardoga. They are a Christian extreme metal band from Norway, formed in 1994.
Christian extreme metal, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
They've got quite the fight in Norway, then.
It's like Amy Grant, but louder.
So let's talk a little bit about the Nine.
Okay.
Aaron, you did a show about this on Saucer Life, all about the Nine.
And, yeah.
Chris was on the farm recently with Recluse talking about the Nine. And Soraya says he knows nothing about the Nine. So this will be a learning experience. I know very little about it other than the, kind of like the basic story.
And like you were saying, Adam, people always just kind of like refer to it offhand. But a lot of people are like, what the hell is the Nine?
Yeah, I did want to point out something, though, that it's really found its way into popular culture. I think a lot of it is because of the Gene Roddenberry connection.
Oh.
And...
yeah.
But there's
Aaron's a movie, got some truth about that.
There's a movie from the late, I think it came out in 2009, called I Am Number Four. Have any of you guys ever seen that movie?
Yes. Yeah.
No. I'm familiar with that. He's like a teenager and he finds out that he's actually an alien. And then there's this other girl that's with him, helping him out or whatever. And like he asks, like he's number four. And he, at the end of the movie, he asks her, like, how many of us are there? And she says, there are nine of us. So like it has found its way somewhat into popular culture.
Well, there are some, you know, historical precedents for it. The nine unknown men. There's a precedent in Hindu folklore. And then there's, was it, am I thinking, and then there was one later, was there a piece of literature from the 1800s that included the nine principles? I can't remember
because yeah, I don't have that. There was some sort of like pulp novel sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly. And now I'm completely forgetting what that was. But there is a little bit of a precedent for that. I guess if you want to, you know, jump into it. So the reason why I ended up becoming a little bit of a, you know, armchair expert on the Nine was, again, has to do with, I was brought up in my household. My parents followed this Indian mystic, Meher Baba. And so there's a lot of stuff that I was exposed to, not bad stuff, but just a lot of a culture that I was exposed to, and esoterics as a kid. And, you know, as an adult, sort of coming back to it as like, you know, in a secular way, I started looking into seeing what connections there were to all of, you know, occult history, which I was also interested in with the history of this mystic Meher Baba. And there's actually quite a bit. But in particular, the channeler, Dr. Vinod, who was an individual that Andreas Puharik met. And I guess we can go and talk about Andreas Puharik and who he is after this. But there's this individual named D.G. Vinod, who was Dr. Vinod, who met Puharik at, I believe it was Eileen Garrett's party. This is according to the book Yuri by Andreas Puharik. And Vinod met Puharik in New York in December of 1951 at this party, and they, you know, schmoozing. This is like upper crust people. I think Frances Payne Bolton was there, who was she was part of this whole, you know, circle of very rich people that were involved in a lot of the research happening that Andreas Puharik was doing. So he met Vinod there, who was apparently a professor of philosophy and psychology at a university in Pune. I have not been able to confirm that, but it's funny that Vinod, I guess, was making the rounds during this time because he also met Meher Baba in 1952 when Meher Baba was in New York making this visit, and they met through these two people, Fred and Ella Winterfeldt, who were kind of on the scene between the West Coast and New York in the occult world. And people who are very familiar with that might know of their names. But it's funny because Vinod met with Meher Baba and they had this exchange, the exchange being obviously strange because if people don't know, Meher Baba was silent. He never spoke. He stopped speaking in 1925. So he used either an alphabet board or he had the sign language, but he spoke through interpreters and he told Vinod, this was in May of 1952, that, and this is documented in these books that are document Meher Baba's life from a lot of the Westerners that were accompanying him. And I guess he told Vinod these certain instructions for meditation, and he told him to do it every night at midnight. And I don't know if this has anything to do with what ended up happening later, which was when Puharik took Vinod to the round table, I believe it was called the round table at that time, which was his foundation in December of 1952. It was just Puharik and the lab administrator, Hank Jackson. This is in February 16th of 1952. Vinod started channeling these entities at this laboratory, in New England, these entities called the Nine. And if you want, I don't have any of this stuff memorized in terms of like what the, what specifically they said. You should listen to the Saucer Life episode of the Nine. Do an excellent job of doing dramatic readings of those the wonderful channeled material. But as we were talking about before, it's kind of this boilerplate like contactee stuff. And then later on, what ended up happening is Vinod did this again, but this time there was a bunch of rich people who were having their sort of, seance there with Andreas Buharik. And a lot of people have talked about the fact that some of these people being like, the guy who founded Bell Helicopter and, an Astor. So a lot of this, moneyed people who have influence were part of this. And so there's this idea that, they're somehow being influenced by these nine entities, so on and so forth.
Insert conspiracy.
Yeah, that's pretty much what Sinister Forces is about, really. Yeah.
But the one thing that I do have to add to it is really kind of where Vinod came from, because I think it's interesting and I don't think people talk about it enough. Like if Vinod was the first person to talk about the nine specifically, be it real channeling or, a psyop that Puharik was doing through Artichoke or MK Ultra, doesn't really matter. Like it started there, and it's interesting because Vinod ended up going on to be like kind of like a dime store guru in India. And you can look like there's a they have a website on him and stuff like that. And apparently he was hanging out with a bunch of other people where he claims that, he met, who was it? Like, well, he claims he met like Einstein and, was involved in, with stuff Carl Jung's laboratory. Who else did he say? Like, what's his name? Einfried Pfeiffer, who was a protege of, Rudolf Steiner. Apparently he worked with him. So, one of the things that I've tried to do is look a little bit into Vinod, and I'd love to know more about him because I think, he's one of the people, talk about Phyllis Schlemmer and all these other people who ended up channeling, but Vinod kind of was there and then disappeared.
Yeah. And also back in the 50s, one of the things that I didn't realize when I did my episode about this years ago, Charles and, Lillian, I think that was his wife's name, Lothhead, who were involved with the whole When Prophecy Fails thing. Yes. The woman near Chicago who said there's a big disaster coming and the aliens are going to protect us, and then they didn't. Then the Lothheads teamed up with George Hunt Williamson and moved out to Arizona to hang out with him, and we're in South America with him and at his monastery of the Seven Rays or whatever that was down there. And Williamson's career is mixed up with all sorts of interesting people. I'm finally going to get around to doing a William Dudley Pelly episode point down the road. I just need to reread the biography of him. They channeled the Nine as well. One of their people received a message from the Nine, and they hadn't heard about anything that Vinod had done. They didn't know about any of this, but they knew Puharik. So they contacted Puharik and said, "Hey, somebody said, you know, they had this message and that, that it's the same people who talked to V or Vinod." Right. And it's incredible if true, you know, it's one of those things. Then in the 1970s, you know, Puharik is doing all his stuff with Uri Geller and sort of making a name for himself and doing all sorts of other scientific things and working for the government and doing, you know, shady stuff probably. But in the 70s, he hooks up with some other people in, you know, they're in Ossining, New York, the Lab 9. Yeah. And he hooks up with a guy named Sir John Whitmore, an English guy who was sort of... I sort of see him as sort of a promoter of psychic event.
He was a race car driver at one point.
Really?
Oh, he was like an aristocratic race car driver at one point. So, you know,
oh, that's awesome.
Money to blow on.
I love that.
Florida psychics.
Hashtag goals. It's just like collecting pet psychics and driving a race car. And so Buhark hooks up with Whitmore. And then there's this woman named Phyllis Schlemmer, who was a psychic medium who was just like doing like psychic shows and things around, I think down south, in the south. And she had a young man named Bobby who was sort of training him as a psychic healer of some kind. And they come up to Lab 9 to work with Puharik, and Bobby starts channeling the Nine in, I think, 1974 or 73, 74, something like that. But Bobby starts to get freaked out. And long story short, the Nine basically declare Bobby to be, you know, an unsuitable conduit for their message. To which you might ask, well, why did you pick him? You know, if you're basically the Egyptian gods, spoiler, they're basically the Egyptian gods. Why pick a kid who can't cut it? And the horrible thing that gets sort of, you know, left to the side is that, you know, Bobby, he's channeling the Nine. He's trying to share these messages, and he's basically having a nervous breakdown while this is going on. He's suicidal at one point, and they sort of just like say, "Oh, we're done with you. You know, have a good life, kid." And now Phyllis Schlemmer is channeling the Nine, and she will be channeling the Nine into the 1990s and until her death, I think. Although Puharik has sort of bailed at this point, gone on to do other things, but
I think he ended up in Mexico or something like that.
Yeah,
I feel like he at one point during the end of what was happening in Ossining at Lab 9, which I believe in like either 77 or 78, there was like a fire which might have been arson. The mysterious events and Lab 9, you know, disbanded or partially burnt down. And Puharik said that the CIA was after him and he ran away to Mexico. Which,
okay,
you know, yeah, make maybe, of that what you will.
Maybe. What I find interesting is that we mentioned Gene Roddenberry before, but Puharik and the Nine are very keen to get their message out to as many people as possible. And so, unlike a George Van Tassel or a George Adamski or any of these guys who'd be like, well, I'm channeling the stuff, so I'm going to write it down and sort of sell a book out of the trunk of my car at UFO shows. They hire a writer named Stuart Holroyd, who'd written books about psychic stuff and was a well-regarded writer of nonfiction things over in Britain, to write a book. And it was published in the UK and it was published in the US in like a mass market paperback sort of thing. So not a difficult to find book, and it was called Briefing for the Landing on Planet Earth, because the goal was to prepare humanity for the arrival of the Nine. And when you read this book, there's all this channel stuff from Tom, who is also called Atum, the Egyptian god, but Tom sounds friendlier. And you know, it's it when you read it, it's sort of, it reads like a lot of other contactee stuff, but there's also, because it's like 1976 or whatever, there's a whole lot of ancient aliens type of stuff in here. Humanity was seeded by various alien races. The Atlans were in Atlantis, which was destroyed in a cataclysm because they were spending, spending their time exchanging their organs. And it doesn't say which organs, but I have my suspicions. You know, you had the technology to replace organs, so they just did that all the time. It's like, that's weird. But they were ignoring warning signs, and Atlantis blows up and disappears. But the survivors, you know, become the Egyptians or whatever. And when you look at the next episode where I'm going to talk about the Nine, there's a book called The Stargate Conspiracy that goes into this a lot. And what I realized reading that stuff, and I sort of put it all together in my head eventually, was that a lot of the Atlantis, almost all of the Atlantis stuff that the Nine comes up with, it's basically Edgar Cayce. It's Edgar Cayce stuff. It's, which means Edgar Cayce was right, because Nine told the same story, right?
And then King Missile released the song Detachable Penis in the 1990s.
Yes. Yes.
Comes full circle.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for the King Missile reference.
Sorry, that's there. A deep cut for anybody that was around.
That is a deep cut.
Great song.
Synchro Mystical.
They're bigger songs.
Yeah. So the Atlans become the Egyptians, or previously the Atlanteans, and the Huva people become the Hebrews. And
Huva,
like you're saying Hoover, but you're from Boston, like, right?
Jaeger Huva.
Jaeger Huva. And the thing is, it's weird, because sometimes
it's all weird.
It's all weird, yeah. But this is particularly weird to me. Sometimes in contactee books and UFO books, you get a healthy dose of anti-Semitism. I mean, it's
just all roads lead to anti-Semitism.
All roads lead, except this one. This one leads to hardcore Zionist nationalism. Because you know, being the seed of the Huva people, the nation state of Israel is the most important one on earth, and will be the salvation of humanity. And so Puharik and his team are sent to Israel in the 70s to carry out assignments for the Nine, which sound like they just consist of standing around and focusing, I'm doing air quotes, focusing their energy on things that the Nine tells them to focus their energy on to prevent the outbreak of even greater wars than were already breaking out in the Middle East in the 1970s. The sort of Israeli nationalism aspect of it sort of struck me as a little odd. But
this is after Geller's involvement, right? This is after, yeah. Right. And I mean, like, from the conspiracy side of Conspiranormal, it seems very, very, it seems obvious to me that, like, there is some Mossad, you know, alphabet agency stuff going on, and that Geller was part of that. I mean, if anything would, you know, should prove that for you, watch for free on YouTube the documentary Third Eye Spies. There's a point when it's about Russell Targ, and it's about the Stargate program, remote viewing. There's one point where Russell Targ goes to interview Uri Geller about this, and he says something to Uri about, well, don't you think that, you know, maybe the CIA was using remote viewing for, you know, assassinations? And Geller puts his hand on Targ's shoulder and says very seriously, Russell, you don't, the CIA is not in the business of killing people. They would never do that. Which, if anything, proves to you that Geller was a CIA asset, or they have compromise on him, you know, that's right there.
Do we know that if Geller had any kind of connections to the Mossad?
It's I do not have a, I'm sure Recluse viable would say it's source, confirmed. But yeah, I think Recluse would say it was confirmed. It certainly has been quite a bit of speculation on that.
Because one of the things that Israel does and the Mossad does is that they do this thing called Hasbara, where they basically, it's a promotion of State of Israel and Zionism. And wherever that that promotion may lead to. I just wonder if whether or not somehow that element got into that, and that's it started coming out that way in the channeling. Was Puharich? I don't think Puharich was Jewish, though. I don't think
he's Croatian, right?
Yeah, he's Croatian, which, I mean, you could be Croatian and Jewish. Yeah. I don't know. I wondered, but I didn't really see anything. I didn't look super deeply, but I didn't see anything that made me think he was.
Well, you know, just as an aside, Velikovsky's material is... Velikovsky was actually, I don't know if accused is the right word, but a lot of people look at his material and say that he was really pro-Zionist, and because a lot of what he was trying to do was to prove the stories in the Bible, and that he came at it from a Zionist point of view.
I don't know if that really makes him Zionist. He used the Bible as one of the things that he looked into when doing his mapping of, you know, Venus's history.
Yeah, that's just one of the criticisms of Velikovsky.
Yeah, well, people will irrationally criticize Velikovsky because that's what you're supposed to do. So,
sounds like we have a catastrophist on the line.
Wasn't it? Hasn't Larry Scranton basically, you know, or he's done some pretty good. Yes. Velikovsky apologist research recently.
And it wasn't even apologist research. Yeah. That was the interesting thing about it. He just took the modern science and looked at what Velikovsky said and found that Velikovsky has yet to be wrong about anything, and science back in the 50s was pretty much wrong about everything.
Yeah.
Well, the electric universe stuff supports a lot of Velikovsky.
Well, that's partially where it came from.
I don't know about Venus being a comet. I don't.
There is a lot of evidence for Venus being a comet, including the fact that it still has a cometary tail.
Yeah. Well, Orthon didn't say anything about that when he talked to Adam Smith. So,
I'm shocked.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
I mean, should have come up.
That clinches it right there. Yeah. That's
who would know better than the Venusians.
That's right.
Well, one more thing for the nine, weren't the nine being channeled through Jenny O'Connell at Esalen in the 70s? Oh. Or am I this is something that, like, I have this fact in my brain and I don't know where I read it or where it's coming out, but I believe through Whitmore, Jenny O'Connell, who, if anybody knows some of the, you know, folks that were around in like the Esalen, you know, the heyday of Esalen.
That sounds right. Yeah. It's like one of those things, like, I believe I've seen that somewhere before.
Right. Yeah. So if we're just shooting the shit here, I'm going to put that out there as something that might be another weird tentacle of the nine.
Yeah. One of the things, I mean, I mentioned that they liked getting the word out there. I don't know if the book by Holroyd hadn't come out yet or it was still in production, but they contacted Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek fame to write a screenplay for a movie about the nine. And like we said earlier, a lot has been made of this. The Ancient Aliens episode about the nine basically lied about this and said it was the inspiration for Star Trek. I know, it's shocking. It's the inspiration for Star Trek, even though it happened after Star Trek had, you know, stopped. Well, it was the inspiration for Star Trek, the motion picture. No, an old Star Trek episode was the inspiration for Star Trek, the motion picture.
They don't even get their Star Trek geekery right, man.
No,
they don't even understand the canon. Like,
it sucks, man. So Roddenberry needed money. And they were going to pay him money. So he goes and he actually participates in some of the channeling sessions, asks some questions, gets some answers. He's pretty agnostic about the whole thing. He's like,
needed $20,000.
He's got 20, 25, like, or else he was going to lose his house. And they paid him that. He's like, great. So he writes the script. And the script is basically, it would have been a movie about a writer who's hired to write a script about an organization just like the nine. He's also cheating on his wife, and he's, you know, got all these marital problems, and he's having this midlife crisis. And he was the creator of a popular but canceled science fiction show, but he hates the fans because they won't leave him alone. It's just like this Gene Roddenberry midlife crisis nonsense. But they
was
paid
he
him
cheating on Major Barrett
all the time with everyone. Not yeah, it's skeezy. I'm not a huge fan of Roddenberry because all the good stuff in Star Trek was from DC Fontana and Gene Kuhn anyway. So, but then, you know, so his involvement with the Nine was, you know, it was there, but the sort of evidence that influenced even later Star Trek, like Next Generation, it really doesn't hold up when you look at how little after the first year Roddenberry had to do with the day-to-day running of Next Generation. And, you know, the Nine book of channeling stuff from the 90s was called, or the late 80s, is called like Essential Briefings from Deep Space. And oh my gosh, Deep Space Nine. Well, Deep Space is just a phrase. I mean, it's, come on. There was a character called Vinod in one episode, which is like the most direct connection I could see. But,
well, Aaron, could Rick Berman and those guys been influenced by some of that stuff? I mean, if they're, I don't know, if there's like, if they're in LA, it's all a Southern California thing.
Yeah.
Or even if like the Nine gets into the zeitgeist and that's how you end up, because I do think in Deep Space Nine, beyond the character Vinod, there's, you know, essentially like the Nine discarnate entities from the wormhole, you know, that are channeled and, you know, speaking through the Bajorans. Yeah. And I think it's, and again, not saying that like it's the Nine to Roddenberry to this, but more like, okay, so the Nine got into the sci-fi, you know, weird zeitgeist.
Yeah. Or just that branch of spiritualism got into, and I think that's more likely than the Nine specifically. Sure. But yeah, Deep Space Nine, more than any other Star Trek, was much more open to that sort of stuff. And that's one of the reasons Roddenberry hated the concept. And that's thing. He hated it. And that's if he even knew what it was, because mentally he was so gone by that point that it's, I mean, Berman claims up one side and down the other. We told Paramount wanted a new show. We came up with this. We told Gene. Gene was like, sounds good. Gene's assistant, Susan Sackett, said, oh, Gene hated it. He hated it. But she lies about a lot of stuff. But to protect Roddenberry, her job is to protect Roddenberry's reputation. That's, you know, so this, I've gone off on a Star Trek tangent here. But the Nine stuff is interesting, and it has seeped in to the culture. I mentioned that book, The Stargate Conspiracy, from like 98, 99, that sort of ties it into the sort of Graham Hancock New Egyptology and some millennial stuff and Richard Hoagland and the Mars Egypt connection thing. It's a book that's really dated. Once you read it, it's like, oh, this is the most late 90s book you can imagine. But
yeah, I have that book.
Yeah.
I read it in like 2004.
Yeah. Also, Paramount wanted a sci-fi show, and they turned down Babylon 5.
Right.
And then went with Deep Space Nine, which was virtually the same idea. And of course, because Star Trek was an established franchise and the series actually started before the series of Babylon 5, everyone thinks Babylon 5 was a ripoff of Star Trek.
Right.
But he had been shopping that script around for a long time, since the late 80s. I'm talking about Babylon 5. Mm-hmm. Like, he had been shopping that pilot around for a good long time. And that's why I think that it's just kind of like the guy that came up with the intermittent windshield wipers, that like at some point somebody saw the script and it was in their mind and they came up with it. I think that that's probably what happened. Yeah, that's something that they think is what might have happened, was that some people had seen the script like in 1988 or whatever, and by the time 1993 rolled around, it was just kind of like in their minds and they came up with that idea.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it was probably in their heads. You know, they, you know, got a bunch of studio people who see lots of things, so it was probably in their heads. And also, Deep Space Nine was going to be running at the same time as Next Generation, so you can't do a ship show.
Yeah.
So if you can't do a ship show, the options are a planet or a space station.
Mm-hmm.
And space station. So between Babylon 5 sort of, you know, being in circulation for like probably 3 or 4 years at that point, by the time it started developing Deep Space Nine, and we need to do Star Trek, but not on a ship. yeah, it's almost, I mean, this is, you know, this is what they were going to come up with no matter what. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
True.
But there's a lot of overlap with Babylon 5. I like Deep Space Nine better, but there's no denying the similarities.
Babylon 5 is one of my favorite shows of all time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Deep Space Nine was great, but it really kind of gave rise to the redone Battlestar Galactica, which is one of the best TV shows in my
opinion. I love it. I love
that either. I actually stopped Star Trek. Deep Space Nine is the one Star Trek series I never finished.
Ah, that's Voyager for me. I despise Voyager.
Yes. I was fine with all the other ones. It was just Deep Space Nine. And I loved the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, but halfway through that lost me too. I did finish it, but I kind of hated it from the halfway point to the end.
We're gonna have a fight, sir.
No, it's fine. I liked Battlestar all the way through, but I don't pretend to understand it. And if somebody says what happened, I'm like, I don't know. Yeah, it makes no sense. No, but I just love watching Edward James Olmos act. You know, it's like
watch him
all day.
Aaron, does that Gene Roddenberry script exist somewhere?
It does exist somewhere. I've never seen a copy of it. But the guy who wrote the one honest biography of Roddenberry had access to a lot of his papers and stuff. And I shouldn't say honest, the non-hagiographical biography of Roddenberry had access to it. And I think it's probably one of those things you could have bought in a dealer room at a convention back in like 1987 or something like that, like some sort of surreptitious photocopy. His assistant, John Povel, was supposed to be, he actually got to do the rewrite or was asked to do the rewrite, and he was going to produce it. I think at some point in like the early 2000s, he's talking about he was going to get this nine script produced, but I don't think it ever happened.
Before we leave the nine alone, I want to kind of get back into why it's been such a focal point of so much conspiracy theory. And like, besides the Israeli stuff we talked about, like what other utility does it have in some kind of political conspiracy?
As for the conspiracy stuff, I think part of it is, as Chris mentioned before, there's a lot of powerful people and influential people in industry and government sort of on the fringes of this.
So the possible supernatural influence on the elite.
Right. And that Stargate conspiracy book, Picknett and Prince sort of go into that angle somewhat ludicrously at some points. They talk about one of the people involved was, or who had a supposed interest in the Egypt stuff and possibly Richard Hoagland stuff. You know, there was some congressman who was on the committee that oversaw NASA. So the fix was clearly that this guy who was a Hoagland fan was on this committee. Senator Claiborne Pell was supposedly interested in it as well. And she draws a link, he and she draw a link between Claiborne Pell and Al Gore, because Al Gore was an environmentalist, which is also sometimes associated with the New Age, and Pell and Gore were both Democrats. Could the influence of the nine be at the very doorstep of the White House? Right. It's like, no. Claiborne Pell did the Pell Grant. Nobody else cares about anything else he did. You know, he's Claiborne Pell. But there's this sort of sense that influential people have been influenced or are devotees of this line of thinking and these efforts. And so they will implement policies to push whatever agenda might be in the shadows into operation.
Yes.
I think it could be a fun game to give Aaron two completely disconnected topics and see how quickly he can turn them into a conspiracy.
About 30 seconds. Yeah.
The thing with Geller too, is that he never was actually or specifically, like who he ended up saying he was being controlled and channeling was an entity called Spectrum, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
So it was, he was never specific to the nine. I think it's another one of these circumstances where you have these overlapping, it's a giant Venn diagram here. So I don't know. I mean, personally, I've never, beyond what I think Aaron, you know, just said about why there would be a conspiracy around it, I think it's been perpetuated by, you know, the Stargate book and Lavenda. And, you know, I mean, we've all talked about how suspicious Lavenda is, you know, and why he would be doing something. So I don't know. Is it one of those things where it's like, you know, disinfo that's out there, or is it a juicy story that somebody can make a buck off of as they keep on perpetuating it? But I think those two books have been the biggest, you know, sort of, I guess they've contributed the most to it being sort of a political worldwide conspiracy, you know, control conspiracy.
Does Lavenda have connections beyond the just I want to make money? Does he have political things going on?
Lavenda?
He's on Gaia TV.
Right, yeah. That's making money.
So it was more of the idea that, like, some people, I think, speculate that his involvement with, like, the wandering bishops, and there was this, like, church that he was, you know, part of that was essentially kind of a front for a lot of, I don't know if it was FBI or CIA, but there was just, so it's a lot of speculation. Again, this is not something I am an expert on, or I, you know, the details of, but what I have read and come across is, yeah, there is, you know, who he was involved with in the, like, what was it, the late 70s, early 80s, beyond the occult scene there. The idea is essentially that there were government agents that were infiltrating that area there, and that he might have somehow gotten involved with that. This is like the New York occult scene.
We got beeps going on back here. That's weird.
That wasn't me. Wow.
No, I don't know what was happening.
It's the nine.
It's Lavenda, yeah.
So the first I ever heard of the nine was the Stargate conspiracy. And then the second book about the nine was the first Sinister Forces, which I've only read the first one. And the Stargate conspiracy one, I mean, it's interesting in, and I mean, I think they may have somewhat of a point that it kind of felt like that some of the things that the nine were talking about, some of these things about the foot around the paws of the Sphinx and finding the chamber and all these type of things that, some of these people like Hoagland and Graham Hancock were motivated by some of the things that were said previously by the nine, and they were trying to tie it in. I could probably believe that about Hoagland. I don't know about Hancock.
Yeah, I don't see that with Hancock at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you've had them on the show. You've had Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince on.
Yes.
Yep. Have you talked about that at all, about that book?
No, I don't think so. Because I had them on for the most recent book, which was God's Wife or whatever, when God had a wife.
Mm, right.
The removal of the sacred feminine in religious texts over the centuries.
Yeah, they're big on the Mary Magdalene stuff.
Yeah, and I had just Lynn on talking about her own personal weird experiences.
They also had a really good book about one of their first books that was about the Shroud of Turin, basically being made by Leonardo da Vinci as a kind of like primitive type of photograph. And I thought that one was really fascinating. And then there was the Templar conspiracy that was kind of a follow-up to that. And so, I mean, their stuff is, I think, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
They're the ones who basically inspired the book that became the movie there.
Da Vinci Code?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Well, that and Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but...
Right, but Holy Blood, Holy Grail took a lot of stuff from them.
Yeah.
They're actually in the Da Vinci Code.
Like, yeah, they got a cameo in it. Yeah. Yeah.
After taking part in the, this is just a little bit of fun facts here, after taking part in the National Treasure film series, Nicolas Cage, using his vast fortune, started on a quest to find the Holy Grail, which ended up leading him to purchase a couple of castles in Europe.
That's wild.
Like he went deep. Like he, that's like wild. What we all would do if we had millions of dollars. He did that. There were some tax things that happened and he lost the castles. And wow. I think that's why he's doing all these movies now. But this recently came out and I read an article and I was like, damn, well, you know,
wow.
Yeah.
Hey, as long as he keeps doing movies like Mandy and the Color Out of Space, I'm all for it.
And Willy's Wonderland.
Willy's Wonderland, Mom and Dad. There's another one coming out. Chris, did you send me the trailer?
The new one that's coming out is, I think, going to be awesome. Ghosts of something. I forget. It's like, yeah, he's like fighting like a alien samurai.
Now that's entertainment.
Willy's Wonderland was as dumb and ridiculous as I thought it was going to be. It did not disappoint.
No, not at all.
In any way.
It wasn't like other movies of that ilk. Like his character made it so strange.
Right. And he doesn't say a word the entire movie. Totally silent.
Didn't want to get us too much on a Nick Cage, but I part of me was actually thinking, like, you know, a person that has that much money in terms of resources. And, you know, I don't know if he's necessarily, you know, he seems like a smart guy. I think, you know, he's probably is reading these books that we're talking about and he's saying, okay, well, I'm going to fly there and I'm going to buy this castle. I'm going to, you know, like Rene de la Chate. I'm mispronouncing it. What is it?
Rene
del Chateau.
Rene Le Chateau. Yeah.
Rene Chateau or whatever. Yeah. But he wasn't purchasing that. And apparently it didn't go anywhere. He said he just like it, you know, he's like some things they just, you know, keep on spiraling.
Well, where does the dinosaur skull fit into that? But also Soraya mentioned Color Out of Space. That guy who directed that and was going to direct Island of Dr. Moreau, he actually lives in the south of France, and he's all into the whole Cathar mythology and all that.
Yep.
And I think the next one's the Dunwich Horror.
Is it the same? Is it Richard Stanley?
Yeah, Richard Stanley.
Name? Yeah.
Because they're doing three, and the second one's supposed to be Dunwich. I'm really hoping the last one's going to be Mountains of Madness.
Go have a Lovecraftian trilogy.
Yep.
Nice. Yeah. Color Out of Space was really good.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we'll stop talking about Nicolas Cage, boo.
Sorry, that was my fault.
And Star Trek.
Yeah. Rage about Cage and Roddenberry. Normal.
Hey, we could talk about anything.
It's a conspiracy. Also, we challenge Aaron to connect two completely unconnected things and make a conspiracy.
It's everything. Everything's connected. Right. Connect the dots, man.
Let's go ahead and just try that one time, Soraya. Give him two.
Give me two things.
I'll start with the X-Files and Hulk Hogan.
Okay, here's the thing. X-Files, we all know that Chris Carter had connections in the government to, you know, get information about the X-Files, right? To get information on procedures and what the government might actually be investigating. We know that, right? Well, Hulk Hogan, here's the thing. When Vince McMahon of the WWF went on trial for steroid distribution back in the late 80s, early 90s, that time, Hulk Hogan, you know, sort of, you know, he was looking pretty good, right? But then went out of the WWF over to WCW pretty quick after that. Well, here's the thing. Hogan talked to the feds, and Hogan gave the feds stuff on McMahon. But the problem is that the people Hogan was talking to were not the steroid people. The people Hogan was talking to were the X-Files people, or the not quite X-Files people yet. So what ends up happening is there is a huge confusion into, you know, what Hogan is saying about anabolic steroid abuse in professional wrestling and what the FBI people are hearing about, you know, oh, there's a weird chemical that's making people weird and bulgy. And so these stories get transmitted to Chris Carter, which is how we get some of those Monster of the Week episodes on the X-Files. It's all a confusion of Hulk Hogan's, you know, informing on Vince McMahon that got routed to the wrong set of FBI agents. And it also explains why the government's case against McMahon was laughably weak and why he walked. So, you know, it's not, maybe not a conspiracy, but more of a bureaucratic screw up, which I think is what a lot of conspiracies end up being.
That's amazing, Aaron.
Wow.
That was beautiful.
Bravo. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you.
Bravo. I'm speechless. I have to ask you, since it's been a little bit, I've really been, I think, except for the latest Afterlife episode, I'm pretty much caught up with Saucer Life. The whole Sherry Steiner thing, was that who it was? Yeah, those particular, I think you did one main episode and like a couple of Afterlife episodes on that, and that was somebody you'd actually had some contact with. And you know, it's like a QAnon type of thing.
It really is. And that story that just broke a couple weeks ago about the dad who killed his kids, right, with the spear fishing gun, because of the reptilian DNA, I was just like, shit. Yeah. Sherry Shriner, man, from beyond the grave, still messing stuff up. But yeah, Sherry Shriner was back in like 2004, 2005, was because of some interactions on a message board, was convinced I was either a demon or a CIA agent, or maybe both. And and she was like, she doxed me, and before that was, you know, what they called it. And I had to tell my wife, you know that crazy woman I've been talking to on the internet and talking about? Yeah, she knows where I live and work and everything. And my wife was not happy. And then when the whole Sherry Shriner thing sort of blew up and there was that murder and everything, I was just like, oh man. I mean, I knew it was bad. I didn't know it would get that bad. And I had no idea people would actually listen to her the way they did. And it's literally insane. And it was, you know, and her, because her stuff was so stupid, just so stupid and derivative. And she, you know, take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and oh, Bible codes. Well, oh, you know Hebrew? No, I have a software program. It's like, idiot. It was just so dumb, and other dumb people thought it was smart because she sounded smart to dumb people, and she convinced them of all these threats, and some people acted on them, and a lot of those ideas that she helped promulgate have sort of soaked into that, you know, into that fabric of that corner of the conspiracy world, the whole reptilian. I mean, you know, David Icke shares a lot of, you know, the lion's share of blame for that. But I think there's a lot of people who would never read David Icke who would read somebody like Sherry Shriner, because she speaks in the weird sort of para-evangelical language that they're used to hearing, as opposed to David Icke, who sounds like David Icke. Mm-hmm. And, which nobody should listen to, but it's wild. And between that and the guy killing his kids and the murder with the Sherry Shriner people, it's like, you know, I remember when conspiracy theories were way more fun.
I don't know anything about Sherry Shriner.
Oh, she, God, it's almost too massive to explain. She believed she was, you know, that there's demonic forces at work disguised as aliens and ascended masters. You know, don't believe the New Age alien stuff, because, you know, it's really a trap from Satan. But then she sort of wove shape-shifting reptilians into it, and she sort of wove denouncing anybody she disagreed with via, you know, well, the Bible codes say they're untrustworthy, so don't believe this person. And she really built up a little cult of people who just listened to her pronouncements. She manufactured little orgone pucks that she said would destroy the demon alien motherships and things. So she used orgone. So it's like, which is not, you know, you don't go down to the local Baptist church and pick up some orgone at the bake sale. You know, this is, you know, she was just blending all of these weird things that she had very little understanding of, and sort of making this stew of dangerous dumbness. And it's difficult to explain her, because she doesn't fit into any particular category. Because her theology was so far outside the lines of any sort of Orthodox Christianity that it's just not, you know. She's like,
it's like this syncretic conspirituality mixed with
it's a lot of stuff. You know, the real Christianity, you know, Saint Paul was, you know, was a demon. I'm like, you what now? It's like, okay, exactly what kind of Christian category do you belong in? That, you know, well, you know, I'm a Christian, but I still obey all the Old Testament feasts, you know, even the ones the Jews don't anymore. You know, it's weird. It's sort of this sort of Judaic archaeo Christianity, like, well, we're like the church from the first century. It's like, really?
Are you? Yeah, it's steeped in the, sounds like it comes a little bit from the Hebrew roots movement.
Yeah, it's a lot of that. A lot of Hebrew roots movement stuff. That sort of appropriation of Jewish tradition. It's weird. She's dead now, so I can finally talk about her.
That stuff is kind of like a way to like trump everything. Like, I'm above everybody because I know the truth, so I get a little bit of this and that. I know the real New Age stuff, the real Christianity.
Right.
It's a form of Gnosticism.
It really is.
It's the way Dr. Future kind of puts it.
Yeah. So yeah. She went
after you, Aaron?
This was back before she was really anybody. I kind of poked the bear, right? I was basically, they didn't call it this at the time, but I was shitposting on a forum that she was on. And not, you know, in a like, oh, you suck sort of way, but in a sort of like arguing with her sort of way and sort of talking to people who had been burned by her and were worried about, you know, what her teachings were doing, because it was like on a, you know, Christian UFO forum, and like people who were sort of like very sort of traditional Christians are like, this woman is weird and she's dangerous and it's scary. And so she was like, oh, you're all against me. I'm going to find out about you guys. And so it was sort of that sort of thing. So, yeah. And it all started with, you know, same sort of, you know, forum posting and sort of arguing about, and with Pam Shuford, who sort of invented the red list and blue list FEMA death camp stuff back in the 90s. So it connected to her. This is what happens when I did not have full-time employment. This is,
I am actually Facebook friends with Pam Shuford.
Really?
And it is, well, I haven't seen her on there very much lately, so maybe they finally got her, but she's, I mean, it is really entertaining. She also likes to wear, I don't know what it is. It's like made out of a fox or something. It's like this whole, like,
it's like a Gary Spivey headpiece type thing.
it's more than that. It's like a whole, like, you know, coat that she wears, and she has like a wolf's head on top of it and something. I mean, it looks like really, old Viking, it looks really stuff. Cool.
Wow.
You know? But yeah. She first came to attention to me because of the whole witches in Asheville thing, which I actually read that on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, she was deep into that thing. Yeah.
Not familiar with that either.
There were witches in Asheville, apparently.
Oh,
and she was not happy about it.
Yeah. Oh, so that was, it's literally what it sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
So what did anything come of her going after you, Aaron?
No. No, I just sort of vanished off that board and hoped she forgot about me, which I think she did. But I did not utter her name on the internet until I knew she was dead. So
probably the smartest thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, you said something, Aaron, that made me think, you know, it's kind of a cliche how we're always talking about how conspiracy theory used to be more fun. But you know, the more I'm really like digging honestly into the past, and especially like the 80s and 90s stuff, I have so much nostalgia for. Like, in particular, lately, I discovered the name and who's behind this like cable access show that I watched in the 90s that I had long forgotten. And the guy's like a real character, and he had like a little conspiracy clearinghouse called the Phoenix Foundation, and the show was called The Omega Report. But then, found him a few times in the paper because, like, right after Oklahoma City, like a week after, he has all these militia leaders like come on his program to talk about the conspiracy, you know, like a week after that. Of course, it wasn't anyone like them, and as the government and Arabs were involved, etc., all the stuff we've heard before. But like, I wonder if so much of it was that these people we felt were a lot of dangerous people were just like so marginal at the time that it was like we didn't really feel threatened by him. But now that we've seen all these conspiracy narratives like become so mainstream and like in informing policy in the halls of power, it's like a totally different game. But you know, maybe these were like a period of incubation for all these memes that developed, and maybe, you know, maybe while it was more fun for all of us and we definitely have nostalgia for it, maybe we're a little naive at the time too, though.
I think so. Cause, I think what gets me is back in the day, even in the internet era, you had to go looking, right? You had to go and into these corners of the internet or on the late night public access channel or onto Usenet or something, or into the weird bookstore, and you had to find this stuff. And now it's hitting people on social media and YouTube and Facebook, and it's being pushed at people via algorithms and stuff. People who don't have the context for what this stuff is. Like, I see some stuff and it's like that's shared by people who I know are not into this. I'm like, wait, you know what that is, right? You know that the roots of this particular idea you're sharing. Like, no, they don't. It's something that vaguely sounds like something they think they might agree with, so they share it. I'm like, and so it's just inundating people who might not have who don't know to engage the kind of critical thinking skills they need to interpret some of these things correctly. I'm not saying they don't have the critical thinking skills, but they don't have them in a social media information processing context.
A lot of it has to do with exposure, I think.
Yeah.
Like a person having, like, you know, exposure and experience in their life and in what they've had, you know, available to them. You know, they haven't had the opportunity in some cases, I think.
Like, maybe we were kind of inoculated back then, you know, with all that stuff. And so now, you know, you see it and it's, we're already familiar.
Yeah. And we're familiar with the ideas and regardless of what the packaging is. But I think it's a generational thing too. I think there's a generation of people, boomers, who, if it looks like news, it must be news.
Yeah.
This story is presented in exactly the same visual manner that this story is. Therefore, they are both news. And I trust this page, and this page looks just like it. So why don't I just read this and think this is a thing and repeat this? And you know, sort of conspiratorial and goofy ideas from across the political spectrum, you know, right? Mm-hmm. Are, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, sometimes there's some ends of the spectrum that are more subject to this, but it you know, nobody's really immune to it in some ways. But I think it's you know, we're inundated. I think you know, it's weird and it's different. And I do miss stuff, you know, even the content of conspiracy theories. I miss the goofy Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Da Vinci Code stuff. You know, that was fun. Like, old history conspiracies are fun, and they don't necessarily have the kinds of immediate real world implications that some of the conspiracy theories that are more current now have. They have sort of historical, you know, implications, but not, you know, how I interact with my neighbor implications sometimes.
Yeah.
And
I also think that people, kind of these, you know, that it's in many ways, these conspiracy theories, I think for some people are, they are a better reality than facing up to, you know, what is the sort of, it's boring yet horrible that, you know, late capitalism, you know, social inequality, you know, breakdown of, you know, certain standards that we have going on, or just realizing that your government isn't a perfect machine and that this is a broken system, you know. And I think for some people, boomers included, you know, there is this, like, it's like waking up from a dream, and, you know, that can be pretty harsh. And if there's somebody to blame for that, rather than it being everybody's fault,
yeah,
that's pretty nice.
Yep. Oh yeah, absolutely. We need some scapegoats. Yeah. It's
there's also the thing that if you don't know enough about a subject, anyone with confidence in a solid presentation can sound convincing.
Yep.
Mm. Which is why, like, someone new to UFOs can listen to Stephen Greer and be like, oh, no, this guy knows what's going on.
Yep.
Whereas if you've been studying this stuff for decades, you look at Stephen Greer and be like, yeah, he's kind of a used car salesman.
Yep. Absolutely. It's
same with Ancient Aliens. You know, you can watch it and be like, oh, that's interesting. I mean, they got it all wrong, but it was interesting to see that stuff, you know?
Yep.
They seem to have a certain amount of authority and a certain amount of gravitas. And that,
right.
Oh, Paul Hellyer was the Canadian Minister of Defense. Well, we better listen to this guy. No, please don't, because he's dead. But
Paul Hellyer would come up a lot in a lot of my conversations.
Yep.
And I would just be like, well, you know, he's really not saying that there's definitive proof. It's just that he's into it. That's it.
Yeah, there was nothing when he was defense minister. There's nothing about him being defense minister was relevant to anything he said about UFOs. It's just like, I believe there are 57 alien species on the Earth. Also, I was the Canadian Minister of Defense. And like, oh, wow, the Canadian Defense Ministry said there are 50. And so there we go. We connect we connect the dots.
Well, we were talking about science fiction earlier, too. And, you know, it's like, I think a lot of this is about like engaging in imaginal realms. I've gotten to the point where, you know, I've really learned why I'm so fascinated by this stuff. A lot of the conspiracy stuff and the nostalgic 80s and 90s stuff, it puts me in kind of a decompressed, altered, imaginative state just listening to some crazy shit from, like you say, Aaron, how you like to listen to like Hour of the Time in the background to just give some atmosphere. You know, and like, so I'm honest about like, I want to go into this weird state and listen to some wacko on shortwave radio. Like, but a lot of people aren't honest that that's probably what they're seeking more than anything. Like, are these altered states associative, making associations and patterns and
it's good exercise for the synapses, right? It's like conspiracy stuff. It's a puzzle. It's a way to do puzzles. I don't like puzzles, but I like conspiracy theories, and I think it satisfies the same part of the brain sometimes.
But people like us had like, we kept a lot of this stuff at a distance, and we also looked at it like anthropologically, and you know, we liked the stories of the characters and their shticks as entertainers also, but all that now just seems kind of lost.
Yeah, it's hard to tell people you're into this stuff nowadays. You know, it's I'm always very careful to say I'm interested in conspiracy culture. You know, it's like,
I say the same thing.
Yeah, you got to. Otherwise, it's like one of my areas of study is conspiracy culture. Like, yeah. I like conspiracy theories. You can't say that. You know,
you wrote an excellent book on it.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, the thing is, though, conspiracies happen all the damn time. But that doesn't mean everything's a conspiracy, and
right.
There's no discernment there at all.
Yeah,
not anymore.
If you deny conspiracy A, oh, so you don't think, you know, the government's up to stuff? Well, yes, I do. I just don't think they're up to this. Right. It's have you heard of MKUltra? Yes, I have. That doesn't mean we never went to the moon.
Right.
You know, everybody just needs to take like an intro to logic class and.
Yeah.
You know, what needs to pass an intro to logic class and we'll be in better shape.
And maybe. And people are so set to look at everything in a binary, black or white.
Yep.
Either this or that. I mean, when you look at the paranormal, it's either you believe in aliens in here in spaceships or you don't believe in UFOs.
Right.
You know, but wait.
Well, I'll say this too, you know, Sir Phil's bringing up science fiction. I mean, look at like right now with the whole, I'll just say the V word. I won't actually say it. Everything that we have going on with the V word right now, how many people are informed by something like I Am Legend, right? I mean, that's a movie or a book, you know, or a novel, but it has no bearing on reality.
And
it's
like four movies.
Yeah. Right.
But, and if you go and look back to where like things like Theosophy came from, things like, I was revisiting like Ren's presentation from last year's conference where Hollow Earth ideas came from. A lot of this stuff comes from fiction.
Yeah, the Vril specifically.
But then it develops its own, universe, and people engage in it. And it becomes real, and that's kind of what we're seeing in this.
Well, I've noticed too that, you know, I've gone back and like basically listened to the Patreon. You'll know that it kind of gone back and looked at a lot of like older paranormal cases. I mean, we talked about the Dybbuk box, and basically, you know, the creator of the whole where the Dybbuk box story comes from, he's come out and said now that it was basically like a creative writing project in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've also got that going on too. So now I wonder, stuff like the Black Eyed Kids and all this kind of stuff that we've kind of just taken for granted in the paranormal as being quote unquote real, how much of it is a creative writing project or just a somebody's project?
Look at Slenderman.
I was just going to say, yeah. Slenderman. That was like one of the first things.
But Slenderman, we've known was fake from the very beginning.
Right. And that's yet what you think. Still had real encounters.
Yep.
Which says something, I think, deeply about how we interact with our own reality, how we create it to some degree, or at least how we identify stuff when we encounter something weird. Maybe people are having Slenderman encounters because they're encountering something weird.
Yep.
Slenderman's what their brain puts on.
Right.
And that ties into a lot of like ideas that I'm trying to really articulate right now about, you know, if that's how the universe works or that's how things like magic works, then conspiracy theory itself is operating in those same kind of paradigms, I think.
Yep. Sure. Well, I mean, you get back to the idea of, you know, I could quote it from two different things, but they're actually both coming from the same place. There's, you know, David Lynch talking about, you know, who's the dreamer of the dream. If you like David Lynch, or the idea that this is, you know, the Vedic idea, which is really where David Lynch gets it from, that this is a dream, that we are a dream. And I know I just skipped over, you know, 1,000 steps to get, you know, into really deep philosophy there, but, you know, I do think that it is, it's beneficial to think of this in terms of, you know, really, you know, existential fundamental questions about reality. And I do think that that's why you see this circling back and forth, you know, the para-weird into religion, because, you know, they imminently overlap. And I don't just mean, you know, Christianity. I mean, the history of trying to figure out why we're here and what we are and what we're doing. And as the limits of, you know, our phenomenal material science, you know, leave us with some people with burning questions, I think, you know, you get people are creating things, but, you know, the idea of whether or not we ourselves are, you know, we're creating our own reality, that certainly has been something people have been wondering for I think ever since we were around and had symbolic thinking, you know, going on.
Go ahead, Sarai.
Oh, there are a ton of examples too of things with like UFO encounters that appeared first in fiction, sometimes in very obscure fiction, only to be reported as real things later.
Yeah.
With the whole Dybbuk box thing that I was talking about earlier, I mean, there were actual paranormal things that happened with these boxes, even though they were made up. They were not old wine cabinets that were made by a Holocaust survivor to curse the Nazis or whatever. You know, I mean, that whole thing's made up, but people were actually having paranormal experiences with them.
Well, I think a lot of the energy that paranormal experiences use come from us. So if we're focused on that thing being scary, even especially subconsciously, that might direct it toward that thing.
Yep. I think it's way more complicated than just saying, oh, it's fake. I think there is a real component to it. So
the world is vastly more complicated than any of us understands.
That's for damn sure. Guys, as we're kind of concluding here, you all are going to be with us, all three of you, at the Strange Realities Conference coming up October 15th through the 17th.
In one form or another.
Yeah, in one form or another. So we actually went early, as we're recording this, we went live earlier tonight with an announcement. But you guys, I just want to get you kind of just what you guys are going to talk about. We'll start with you, Chris.
So We talked about this a little bit. In this idea of, you know, where do some of these tropes of, you know, the occult and the esoteric come from? And, you know, do they come from fiction or are there, you know, real instances of that? So what I'm actually going to be talking about is I'm going to be talking about the notion, the tropes of secret chiefs, ascended masters, Mahatmas. And then what is the cosmology and mythology from the order, the lineage of the mystic Meher Baba that my parents followed. He passed in 1969, the past century. But this was a, you know, at the time, living, breathing person that many, many, you know, Westerners, so in primary English speakers, knew and spoke with, and there is a whole cosmology of essentially secret chiefs that this, you know, lineage of sort of a hybrid Vedic Sufi Zoroastrian lineage comes from. And so I'm going to talk about that, and you know, it will be one example. You know, again, not saying this is true or not, but here, you know, are one documented example of, you know, sort of a living, breathing philosophy based around this idea of secret chiefs, but that works in sort of a different way than theosophy does.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to be talking about saucer felons, about criminals in the flying saucer scene. So
is Reinhold Schmidt going to be
Reinhold Schmidt. Nice. Reinhold Schmidt. We got Frank Stranges and his plane full of pot. We've got some others. So, and you know, are we going to always talk about convicted felons? Well, no, but just like maybe in some cases, strongly probable felonies. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, hopefully, more sort of fun and light. So, because awesome. A lot of the topics at this conference are going to be very, very thinky, like, yeah. The hidden cosmology of the secret chiefs. So exactly. I'm going to have Reinhold Schmidt ripping off old ladies with bad land deals for a little bit.
I look forward to that.
All right. So, and Soraya, what are you going to be talking about?
He's going to be channeling the nine live.
I was just going to say that. How did you know? I'm going to answer all the secrets of the universe by channeling the nine live on stage.
You should just add Seth in there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seth will drop by for a few minutes.
And Raw.
No, I don't like Raw.
No. Ashtar. Ashtar's got to come Ashtar. Back at some point.
Yeah, Ashtar should stop in. It'll be a very interesting and unpredictable conversation. More likely, I'll just talk about whatever's on my brain that week that I take notes about and do a talk about.
Whatever paranormal experiences you have on the way to Nashville.
Right. Okay, so when I show up 3 hours late because I was abducted by a strange light in the sky.
Which could happen.
And picked up on the side of the road by a black Cadillac.
Right. And oddly enough, Aaron Gullius was in it. However, Aaron Gullius was already at the convention.
Ah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Bardoger.
I do have, so just so you guys know, the audience out there, Aaron, do have you speaking Friday night.
Okay.
And, Chris is going to be sometime on Saturday afternoon, and Soraya will be sometime Saturday evening.
Yay.
So I just mapping out the awesome. Schedule. So just to let everybody know that we're going to have a schedule up pretty soon as well.
We're having to check the position of the planets and everybody's zodiac sign and everything.
So. Yes, absolutely. And also, we should mention that we're going to try to be as safe as we possibly can. We are going to require proof of vaccination at the door or a negative COVID test within 72 hours. This
Your
is just
papers,
the world
please.
That we live in. So everybody else around us, venue-wise, is doing this at the moment. So I think that we're going to be doing the same thing. So.
Cool. Yeah, of course. You know, a lot can change in 2 months. So,
a lot can change in 2 months. That's true.
For better or worse.
Right. So, we are in an extremely liminal time.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for the X gene to kick in.
So are we all. So, I think we'll go ahead and close it. If you guys would we're going to do a Patreon segment if you guys would like to hang out, which the Patreon audience may have already heard. Guys, again, Strange Realities Conference, all three of these gentlemen will be there. Nashville, Tennessee, October 15th through 17th. That is $70 to come, and we are restricting that also to 40 tickets only, so we can kind of limit the amount of people that we have there. But that does not mean that you cannot attend, because we do have the $30 online as well. So if you want to still see these presentations, you can buy a ticket, get into the secret Facebook group to view those presentations. Also, we'll probably have an alternate for people that don't use Facebook as well. Looking at Twitch doing that.
You said $70 for the weekend. What if someone wants to come for one day?
We probably are not going to do that because we're limiting tickets.
Gotcha.
So we were thinking of doing that, but since we don't want to be a super spreader event, we're
only letting in
people who... Again, though, things might change. I mean, you know, it is 2 months away, and so we may open it a little bit more. It just depends. We are telling everybody, though, get your tickets as soon as possible if you want to come. I mean, the hotel that you guys will be staying at, we've got a block of rooms there, and that special was good for like September 14th. So if somebody hasn't come from out of town and you haven't gotten your room yet, try to get your tickets as soon as possible.
I did want to let Aaron know that I think you guys are going to be pretty close to the Fiddler's Inn, which is mentioned as a spot of mind control monarch programming in several early 90s conspiracy tomes.
Nice. A little Kathy O'Brien action.
Then. Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. Tell everybody where they can find you guys, starting with Mr. Soraya.
WhereDidTheRoadGo.com. And, TheLastExit.org if you like heavy music.
Which who doesn't? You can go to brightrectangle.com, and that's where my stuff is. And the movies that I make with Bill Darman, you can link through there too.
All right. And Mr. Gullius?
Saucerlife.com.
All right. Also highly recommended. Okay. All right, guys. Thanks for hanging out with us. Surfiel can tell everybody where they can find our Patreon if you want to help us out.
If you want to check out these weekly awesome Patreon episodes and join the International Order of Conspiranormalists, go to patreon.com/conspiranormal. At the $5 level, you get one of these episodes every week. And at the $10 level, you get to hang out every month in the Mystic Crew, which is kind of like our own little mini Strange Realities, where we have presentations every week and kind of serves as a really cool think tank or idea incubator. For people in our orbit and guests, let you get access to those guests too. So check us out at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
Do it now.
All right. Thank you guys. And we will be back with another roundtable next week. We will talk to you later on
Conspiranormal.
Consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.